Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini, represented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Danny LaRue is in the building. We are going to run through all 15 teams in the Western Conference and what they did this offseason, all the moves they made. Did they get better? Did they get worse? What does the Western Conference look like heading into the 2020-2021 NBA season? Danny, how you doing, man?
Doing pretty well. I can't really complain. I am a little bit concerned about how rapidly we're going to try, emphasis on try, to move through this, but we'll do our best.
I'm concerned about how rapidly the NBA season is trying to move through this 2020-2021 season. So we shall press forward regardless, just because that's what we do here, Danny. How are things going in San Francisco for you?
I mean, California is in our new lockdown, but I you know, like, my life is fortunately relatively manageable under these circumstances, and I think the people around me are doing a good job being safe, so no complaints.
That's great. Yeah. Obviously in a bit of a different circumstance here in Australia in regard to safety, but I don't think we need to dive into that, just to make the American listeners here jealous. So, Danny, let's dive in, and we're going to go in alphabetical order here. We're not going to, you know, go story by story. It's just easier for listeners to find the teams that they're looking for if we go in alphabetical order. So we're going to go Dallas, Denver, Golden State, Houston, Los Angeles Clippers, Los Angeles Lakers, Memphis, Minnesota, New Orleans, Oklahoma City, which will take a while trying to just navigate all of the things that Oklahoma City did this year. The Phoenix Suns next, Portland Trail Blazers, Sacramento Kings, San Antonio Spurs, and then the Utah Jazz will close us up. So Danny, the way this will go is I'm just going to read off a list of transactions that each team did to introduce our discussion, and then we'll just talk about it for a little bit. So let's start with Dallas. Dallas drafted Josh Green, Tyrell Terry, and Tyler Bay. They traded Seth Curry for Josh Richardson and the pick that they used to select Tyler Bay. They brought back Trey Burke on a 3-year, $10 million contract. Willie Cauley-Stein opted out and then was re-signed to a 2-year, $8 million deal with a team option. They signed Wes Iwundu at the vet minimum. Obviously, Tim Hardaway opted into that $19 million player option. And then they also re-signed JJ Barea at a 1-year deal at the veteran minimum. So, Danny, what is your thought on Dallas? Because it was a very simple offseason, but I also really liked the big move that they made.
I like the big move as well, and that is a little bit surprising considering I am a fan of Seth Curry, and I thought he fit in well with Luka. You know, the idea of somebody who is point guard sized but doesn't have to have the ball in his hands all the time, that is something that describes Seth Curry. But I really like Josh Richardson there. I thought that he was miscast last year on the Sixers. They had this weird lack of a half-court creator, and that's not what Josh Richardson is best at. And so I think that in his defensive capability, I think that's one of the kind of through lines of Dallas's offseason that I like, is they brought in some defenders. And so overall, I think they did a good job. The challenge for me that is different from you is that I'm not ready to evaluate their draft picks, and that will be an important part of how their offseason is evaluated long term. But in terms of the players that I know, I think they did well.
Well, and hilariously, in the middle of talking about this, 1 minute ago from Tim McMahon, the Mavs plan to release JJ Barea on Thursday. Mark Cuban knew this move was likely when Barea signed a 1-year, $2.6 million deal last week, but he wanted to reward him for his impact over 11 years with the Mavericks. How about that? Good. This is how you engender goodwill around the NBA, Mark Cuban. I like it.
Yeah, and I mean, now maybe JJ Barea is going to be an extremely high-paid assistant coach. You know, I paid with his NBA salary. It wouldn't shock me if they do that. And it kind of seemed like Barea was going to be the odd man out. Remember that Dallas had 16 guaranteed salaries. And so it kind of made sense that Barea would be the one when they added so many guards, you know, that he could be the one. And Wes Iwundu, they gave a 2-year deal to. And so you wouldn't expect it to necessarily be him. And also this kind of has the Mavericks trying to build that culture idea, you know, with Dirk and everything else. And so it's not a surprise. And I like Bray even up to like I was how quickly he got back after his injury, but this is the right decision.
It's no doubt the right decision. It's just one of those deals that engenders goodwill for your organization from the player body at the end of the day. So,
so the question I want to ask you, because you know these guys better than I do at this point, is Josh Green and Tyrell Terry more their fit within the current Mavericks and what Rick Carlisle does, because we have a pretty good understanding of that, rather than how they are overall as prospects? Like, I've heard really good things about Terry. It sounds like his conceptual fit is good. And then Josh Green, I mean, if he's a good player, it'll work.
Yeah, so Tyrell Terry is just like a little bit easier to talk about, so let's hit him first. It's kind of a, you know, less ready Seth Curry. Like, I thought that Terry's most likely outcome was something similar to like Seth Curry, Steve Kerr, something like that, versus a guy who was a true point guard. Terry is a genuinely elite shooter. Don't have to worry about that. He's a really high level ball mover and passer who keeps things moving, within an offense. He's very unselfish, but has kind of a high handle and doesn't have a ton of burst and is very skinny. So I think it's going to take him some time, to be able to play anything resembling a point guard role, but I actually really, really like the fact that if you're going to move Seth Curry for Josh Richardson, which in a vacuum, I really like that move, especially given the fact they also got number 36 in the deal, which they then used on a player that I don't love in Tyler Bay, but to get an asset is valuable. Getting a ready-made, not a ready-made replacement, but a potential long-term replacement for Seth Curry in Tyrell Terry, I think was just really smart business by Dallas at the end of the day. Josh Green is, again, a very high-level defender on the wing, 6 foot six, 6 foot 10 wingspan, has a great physical frame, loves to play on-ball defense, and is a pretty smart on-ball defender, although he's going to have to grow there a little bit. A lot of Green's translation is going to come down to the shot. He shot 36 from three this year coming into the NBA at Arizona, but I think the mechanics are a little bit worse than that, and I think it's going to take him some time to work through those, despite the fact that he has some legitimate touch.
Interesting. Okay, so like, yeah, I could see that eventually, you know, that could work out. I have one other thing I want to. Oh yeah, so one of the other interesting nuances, and we're not going to get to Philly in this, of the Richardson for Curry swap is the argument, which I would agree with, that the structure of their salaries actually kind of makes sense for both teams. So Richardson has a player option. I expect him to decline said player option and then become unrestricted, which helps Dallas's 2021 aspirations. Should, you know, Giannis and whatever they want to do. But then the other possibility there that I think shouldn't be discounted this far out is that if Dallas strikes out another guys and Richardson works out, him being an unrestricted free agent means that if Richardson is a later mover than those other guys, that they could just bring him back. And so that is a nice part, that they don't have to make a firm decision. They can kind of string it along a little bit if things work out. I think that's a positive for Dallas.
Yeah, and they did a really good job of clearing salaries in general this offseason. Obviously, they also move the DeLon Wright deal as well, which is something I didn't note in the intro here. But yeah, DeLon Wright does not play for the Dallas Mavericks anymore, and he was on what I believe is a 3-year, $27 million deal, Danny. Is that sound right to you?
Yeah, the second year of it. And they also got off Justin Jackson, but he had no guaranteed money after this year.
Yeah, and it's just like kind of not. He's like a nothing burger to me as a player, unfortunately, for Justin. If they could actually get off of the Dwight Powell money somehow this offseason, there's like a pretty real chance that they might be able to keep the Josh Richardson cap hold as well, right?
Yeah, well, they can also cross that bridge if they need to. Like, that is the sometimes I think teams get too aggressive. I'm not criticizing Dallas for this, at clearing the space ahead of time when you can just do it if you need to. But yeah, I mean, if the situation comes to pass that they need to clear that money and they also want to keep Josh Richardson, that should be potentially doable. Depending on it, though, we should note that Richardson's cap hold is higher, but you know, there are different ways to thread that. The other weird part, and this is something that we just won't know all the details, is Dallas ended up in that three-team trade where the DeLon Wright one. They traded DeLon Wright and Justin Jackson for James Johnson. Trevor Reza went to OKC in that same deal and is sitting on their roster somehow. So I don't know what it would have taken to get Trevor Reza instead of James Johnson, but I think Reza is a materially better player. Their contracts aren't really that different. So it could be a mistake. The other thing that could potentially be a mistake for Dallas is keeping the powder dry for 2021. Now, that could work out brilliantly for them. But, in hindsight, and we won't have that hindsight until August of 21, that, not using the full mid-level on a multiple-season player, not trading some of their expiring contracts for guys that are maybe better but under longer-term contracts, like, those could end up being mistakes, but we won't know.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I think we should move on, though, because Dallas didn't do a crazy amount, and Denver seems like a more interesting discussion here, if only because they lose Jeremy Grant, because Jeremy Grant signs an enormous deal with Detroit that I talked about on one of the most previous podcasts with Dave Dufour that we're a little bit dubious of. They draft Zeke Nnaji at 22. They sign Facundo Campazzo to a two-year deal. They give Monte Morris a three-year $27 million extension in addition to signing Campazzo, which is a bit surprising because both of them are backup point guards in the NBA. They sign Jamichael Green to a two-year $15 million deal to essentially replace some of what Jeremy Grant gave them. They re-sign Paul Millsap to a one-year $10 million contract. They end up drafting RJ Hampton as well. They converted Bol Bol into a two-year $4.2 million deal. Did they sign Isaiah Hartenstein as well?
They did.
And I believe that that's going to be everything for Denver. Did I miss anything there?
They let Torrey Craig go.
They also let Torrey Craig go, who signed in Milwaukee. That's right. So, interesting offseason for Denver. I guess that the first question I have for you is, if you were Denver, it was reported, did try to match the Jeremy Grant three-year $60 million contract. How do you feel about Denver trying to match that contract? Because I feel like they probably ended up in a better spot by just having Jamichael Green on this roster and then hoping that they can get starter-level minutes from Michael Porter.
It's challenging because if Denver had ownership that treated the team this good, this young, as something rare that you treat by paying the luxury tax, then I would say you might roll the dice with Jeremy Grant just because I think he's better. And it's a bad contract, but good teams have bad contracts. Like that's the way it works sometimes. And the next team we talk about will be one of those. And I think that in that circumstance, it's worth it. But if we're treating the luxury tax as a hard line or pretty close to it, then I think that Tim Connelly and his front office did really well, because Jamichael Green is a good player, came at a much cheaper price and manageable for the long term. You don't know if he's going to stick around after this year. And Denver now knows very well that unrestricted free agents can be unpredictable. And so there are challenges there. But I think that They bounce back well. I think that I think Adam Morris, Locked On Nuggets and various other things, DNVR, did a really good job summarizing this, that I don't think the overall moves hurt Denver that much in the regular season, but I think it hurts them in the playoffs because they are less versatile defensively. Things get more challenging around what do you do with Michael Porter, especially if another team has a good wing scorer, that job probably goes to Jamichael Green. But they're still going to be a really good team, and they're, I guess, more cost-balanced than they were before.
So I guess that with Denver, what it comes down to for me is, do you think that they should still be playing the long game, given the fact that Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray are both under contract long-term? Jokic has 3 years left, but do you see Nikola Jokic leaving Denver? There hasn't even been any discussion of that yet. I don't really see it being a thing, right?
I'm not super concerned about it, but you never know. I mean, for me, the third contract is when you find out what a player really wants. And
yeah.
I would say it's not the way I'm thinking, but that's happened before. So I think, and the other big key of that, and this is true of all of these negotiations as we think about them moving forward, is if the team is competitive, it's going to be harder to pry them away.
Yeah,
the Nuggets should be competitive, so it'll be harder to pry them away.
Yeah, and at the very least, they're going to be competitive, if not like outright contenders, right? So I guess that where I'm at is trying to figure out, should they be looking at this long term as we're going about this, waiting for Michael Porter to hopefully explode and become our third star with Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, and then hopefully like RJ Hampton and Zeke Nagy become real players and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Or should we be trying to win a title this year when the Lakers look like a juggernaut and Milwaukee has drastically improved and everything? Like, I kind of think that they should be straddling both lines, but if we're doing like a 55% one way, 45% another way thing, I do think that they should probably be straddling still just slightly more toward the long term than the short term of going all in for a title contender now. And signing Jeremy Grant would have really reduced the flexibility for them over the course of the next few years, I think.
Yeah, it would have. And that is an argument, in some ways, that's more of an argument against trading for him in the first place. You know, like that whole thing that you're ceding so much control to somebody who could leave of their own volition. Now, they couldn't have seen exactly what happened coming. And that, I'm not criticizing Connolly for that. But it is a real challenge. And I think really where the rubber meets the road there is, what is the opportunity cost? You know, like, what is going each way? So in the JaMychal Green, Jeremy Grant kind of conversation, maybe it's that is a large contract, but the difference does matter. However, here's the one kind of general thing I will say is that when a team is this good, and the Nuggets, you know, they've been one of the better regular season teams in the West the last couple of years, and they underperformed relative to their seeding expectations last year or 2 years ago, and then overperformed it this past year, is that unfortunately the general arc of things, I mean, so it can happen that the team blossoms, you know, there have been various examples of that, but it can also happen where something fails them, whether that is a departure in free agency or an injury or something. So my idea is basically always, if you're already really good, try to be as good as you can without burning too many bridges. So like, I wouldn't have supported trading Michael Porter Jr. for a rental, for example. But if it's, you know, spend a little bit of luxury tax money to use the full mid-level exception, if you had the right guy, that's the kind of stuff I would do.
The other kind of points worth bringing up here, Facundo Campazzo, I think, is just a perfect fit in Denver. He is an exceptional passer, ball mover, playmaker, has long been one of the best point guards outside of the NBA. He is really, really, really just dynamic as a passer. He's an unbelievable live dribble passer, and he's going to fit so, so well within this ball movement heavy offense. Like, you're going to be able to play him next to Jamal Murray and play Jamal Murray off ball and just let him fly around the court and make a lot of different things happen. I think that Campazzo, I don't know that you're going to want to have him on the court to close playoff games or anything necessarily, just because he's very small and he is going to struggle defensively, but he is going to be a legit playoff rotation player because of the way that he processes and thinks the game at the highest levels is going to translate exceedingly well at those levels, in my opinion.
An interesting kind of wrinkle with this is that Campazzo at $3.2 million a year for the next 2 years, and remember, because he's an older free agent and the NBA rules on this are so screwed up, he's restricted after that.
Yep.
That, I mean, though he could play internationally if he didn't feel like the offers were sufficient, that having a backup point guard who you don't really want as your starter at that kind of rate makes you wonder why you give another backup point guard who you don't particularly want as your starter $9 million a year after this. But it is like Monte Morris, that's a deal that I don't love, but I definitely don't hate. It's a challenge because like $9 million for a backup point guard is, for a very good one, is totally fine.
Yeah.
But when you think about the luxury tax constraints potentially here and the doubt, like, I love Monte Morris in general. And the story is amazing. How he blossomed into being a viable NBA player and more than that now is great. But I don't love him starting or closing games on a team with aspirations as high as Denver's. So that creates some problems just because that's money that you can't allocate elsewhere unless you trade him or something else like that. So it's not terrible. It's, you know, there were far worse contracts doled out this offseason, including some to former Nuggets. But it's also the type of the type of move that, while far from terrible, you might be sitting there 2 years from now being like, damn, I just wish we hadn't done that. And what makes Morris a little bit different, and it's part of what the contract stuff is so fun, is he was going to be unrestricted. And so I think Denver, sometimes they tie themselves in knots. They also almost always pay their own guys. But the idea of, oh, well, he could leave for nothing. And that's bad. They just got burned on it. But that's what gave Morris the leverage to make this deal happen.
So I guess that my question there would be, I kind of think Monte Morris is more valuable now as a trade chip than he was prior to
this. Oh, I would agree. I would agree with that. But you narrow the field of potential suitors, but you also make them more interested.
Do you narrow the field though? Because like $9 million is actually a pretty good deal for Monte, and it's sub mid-level money.
You narrow it down a little bit just because there's a group of teams that would roll the dice on the low cap hold. And, you know, with that, oh, if you could get Monte Morris and then have cap space and then you could come to some agreement, you know, kind of like not the current Joe Harris deal, but the Joe Harris deal before, where, okay, you go to a number and then you can roll over and then you have your backup point guard locked in. Like, that's the type of thing that certain teams just love, but other teams are risk averse and don't want to do.
Yeah, that's a good point. Better or worse? Do we think Denver is better or worse for this coming season than they were last season?
Worse, but by less than some people think. Also worth noting, I think they committed an unforced error with Torrey Craig. And, you know, like, oh, we had a roster crunch. Well, they chose Vlatko Kanchar and Bol Bol and Isaiah Hartenstein over Torrey Craig functionally, and that's a mistake.
Yeah, I agree with that. Actually, I would have just cut Kanchar and kept Torrey Craig, especially losing Jeremy Grant at the end of the day. Torrey Craig is the kind of wing defender that they need on this roster still. I agree with you. It depends on, are we thinking of Denver as the regular season team they were, or as the team that made the conference finals? I would say they're probably going to be about the same, because I would expect Michael Porter to take a leap this season.
Yeah, but, and remember, they also didn't have Will Barton in the bubble, and Gary Harris was still working his way back. I mean, I think it's entirely possible that Denver is better as a team. I'm just thinking in terms of the net moves forward and backward of the personnel.
Yeah, no, I think that's reasonable. But I think Denver is probably in about the same spot as they were last year. So let's move to the team that you're closest to, the Golden State Warriors. Okay, they drafted James Wiseman. They drafted Nico Mannion. They drafted Justinian Jessup, who will be a stash. Nico Mannion, I believe, is on a two-way, right? Yeah. They traded for Kelly Oubre into that $17.2 million trade exception. I think that they traded like a top 20 protected first rounder for that, right?
Yep. Otherwise, Minnesota's 21 second.
Okay. They signed Brad Wanamaker to a 1 year, $2.25 million deal. They signed Kent Bazemore to a minimum. They signed Axel Toupin and Dwayne Sutton to E10 deals. And I believe that they signed Caleb Wesson to an E10 deal as well. I would venture that one of Sutton or, Wesson are going to be on that other two-way contract. And then the big one is obviously that they lose Klay Thompson and that they gain a $9.3 million trade exception to try and replace Klay Thompson. I mean, the Warriors, that the Klay Thompson injury is just devastating for a number of reasons, but it's devastating because it may cost us a real year of contention from the Warriors near the end of Steph Curry's prime.
Yeah, it costs us a year of knowing what the post-KD Warriors really, really would have looked like. And we already lost one of those, but we knew that going in because Klay had already been hurt the first time. In terms of evaluating their offseason, the Oubre acquisition is so fascinating because it's really how much do you value ownership's money? And if Joe Lacob and Peter Gruber are willing to pay it, by all means. I mean, I think Oubre is one of the best players they could have acquired for that amount of trade exception. And, you know, the cost was, you know, probably it's probably a second round pick. I don't think the Warriors are going to have one of the 10 best records, given that, remember, this happened after the Klay Thompson injury. So I'm feeling like that's not going to happen. It's possible, but not, I wouldn't say it's the most likely thing in the world. And so Oubre helps, and he'll probably be a starter, probably be a closer for them too, just depending on how everything shakes out. And then the other big decision and this is so like when I was doing offseason grades, this is where I downgraded them, is choosing James Wiseman second. Like, I had Wiseman second on my board, but the guy who I had first on my board was not drafted first. So those two decisions, I thought Oubre, as long as you're willing to pay the money, that's a very good decision. And then Wiseman, we'll have to see.
Well, so here's the thing. I liked the Wiseman pick for them, even though I like LaMelo Ball a little bit better in a vacuum than I like James Wiseman. Wiseman gives them something a little bit different as they move into a different era of basketball. I don't love the fit of playing LaMelo Ball next to Stephen Curry. And if they want to try and compete with Stephen Curry, which I think that they frankly should. Do you agree with that? Like, they should try and compete, yeah, even 2022, 2023 with Stephen Curry on the roster.
But I don't think that's how you draft this team. You draft based on who you think is going to be the best player, not who's the best help for the 22-23 Warriors, personally.
Yeah, I still would be considering trying to maximize that 2022-23 window, given the fact that we just don't know what the Warriors will look like after Stephen Curry. Like, they might enter an extended rebuild. This is not exactly a consistent historical contender with the Warriors. They go through lulls over the course of their history, as you know as well as anyone, because you wrote the book on it.
Yeah, it's true.
So I guess that I was okay with the Wiseman pick. And look, the thing with luxury tax is that you don't have to pay the luxury tax until the end of the year. If they find that they are not a playoff team, which I think is plausible. Like, there's a chance that without Klay Thompson, this team is not a playoff team this year. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely possible.
Yeah. Like, I think that they're probably like somewhere in the 6, 7, 8, 9 range, but it's very plausible that they don't make the playoffs, despite the fact that Stephen Curry and Draymond Green are unbelievable at basketball. You can move this Kelly Oubre contract pretty easily and save yourself a lot of money. Like, I don't think that that's going to be that hard.
Right. And there's also, I mean, BRI basketball related income drops below expectations, which we fully expect that it will. That's a weird dynamic right now. That's going to lower the Warriors' tax bill because basically it changes a team's, you could call it, think of it, it changes their tax bracket. Yep. And then the other part of it that I think is a positive for the Warriors with Oubre, again, if ownership is willing to spend, is having his free agent rights. You know, so theoretically, if the Oubre experiment works really well, yep, you could bring him back. Now, it will be comically expensive unless they're moving on from somebody else that's on the roster, but it is a possibility. And so I think that the Warriors generally did well. I like Brad Wanamaker a lot. I thought that,
yeah,
he was a worthwhile addition for a little bit more than the minimum. Bazemore at the minimum is of course totally fine. I think that the Warriors did well overall. This is the kind of offseason that you kind of, I kind of think of this as a bully pulpit offseason, where you use the advantages that you have over everyone else, and that's being able to sign better guys for the minimum than most teams, and being able to use a trade exception even though you're already expensive because you theoretically make more money than them, though the Warriors are not right now. But so what was so weird about that is they did all that right after Klay Thompson got hurt, and they're maybe not that team anymore.
Yeah, I mean, like, a Klay Thompson or a Stephen Curry, Andrew Wiggins, Draymond Green, Kelly Oubre, and then like one of Kevon Looney, James Wiseman at starting center is a totally solid starting lineup, right? Then you bring Brad Wanamaker, Eric Paschal, Marquise Chris off the bench. Like, that's a real 8-man rotation. I worry about what happens when one or two of those guys get hurt, obviously, but this is a real team again. They're going to be fun to watch. They're going to be exciting. And we just have to hope that some of the magic with Stephen Curry continues going forward. Otherwise, this could be a bit of a rough start for the Warriors early in the season. Let's go to Houston next.
Speaking of rough starts.
Yes. Mike D'Antoni steps down. Steven Silas is the new head coach there. They drafted KJ Martin. They signed Christian Wood in like kind of a weird convoluted deal kind of thing. Do you know, can you explain the details of the Christian Wood sign and trade?
Yeah, so basically the Rockets had just acquired Trevor Ariza in that deal for Robert Covington. That deal was they traded Robert Covington for Ariza, the 16th pick in the draft, and a future first. Then they traded Ariza and the 16th pick to the Pistons for an assignment. So and they brought back Christian Wood, who was signed and traded to them. And they also, the Rockets also got a future protected first, but we don't know. Like, so that'll convey, you know, at some point.
They traded Robert Covington for 2 first-round picks. They re-signed Bruno Caboclo, who is still 2 years away from being 2 years away. They signed Mason Jones to a two-way contract. They signed Jayshon Tate out of the NBL. They lose all of, I believe, Damari Carroll, Tyson Chandler, Michael Frazier, Jeff Green, William Howard, Austin Rivers, Thabo Sefolosha. Gerald Green is back on a camp deal. And then a couple a couple weeks ago at this stage, maybe 10 days ago now, they trade Russell Westbrook for John Wall and a first round pick. That is obviously the enormous shift here. They also signed DeMarcus Cousins. It's going to be kind of a weird... This is just a weird roster that has potential to go totally off the rails within 2 weeks of the season starting.
It's so strange because you kind of put all the... Basically, they're kind of halfway through a process, but you don't know exactly what process they're halfway through. Because yeah. it could be a total teardown. Like that is a distinct possibility, but it's a total teardown where you're still paying John Wall a bunch of money and where, you know, you have Christian Wood, who I like, and I like the contract that Raphael Stone signed him to, which is a nice piece. Also, they Daryl Morey leaving and then Stone taking his place. That's another change that happened for the Rockets this offseason. But like, so the weirdest part for me, and I think the answer might just be duh, is the current team makes no sense. Like, for example, they bring in Christian Wood and they bring in DeMarcus Cousins, neither of whom particularly makes sense in a switching system, but that's really the only defensive scheme that you've ever played with James Harden. So you're like, well, what are they going to do? And the answer might just be, it doesn't matter that much, you know, like the Rockets just aren't at that place. Or it might be because they're trading James Harden. I don't necessarily think that's happening right away. But it's kind of a weird circumstance to be in where I don't necessarily dislike any of the kind of personnel moves. You know, they got good value for Covington. You know, they gave up good value for him and then they got it and then they got it on the return. And then the Ariza Wood thing is a little bit weird just because they functionally gave up the 16 pick for this like weird Detroit pick in the future. How you feel about that kind of depends. But when you consider the hard cap limitations, I think that's a big part of why Houston did it the way they did. And then, you know, on the margins, getting guys like Sterling Brown and Boogie if he makes the team and Kenny Wooten and stuff. It's like, yeah, that's all totally fine. And then the Westbrook Wall thing is fascinating because John Wall, my argument would be the idea of John Wall is actually a better fit for the Houston Rockets than the idea of Russell Westbrook. It's just that the idea of Russell Westbrook is more frequently reality than the ideal of John Wall.
Well, we just have no idea what John Wall is going to look like.
Right.
Like we can hear all of these things about him. He's killing it in workouts. He looks great. He looks awesome coming off of this Achilles injury, but like the Achilles track record is not great. And we just haven't seen John Wall in a very, very long time. So
well,
I don't
remember
know.
The team that knows the most about his current situation is the team that just traded him, which has to be a concern.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think that's absolutely right. And yeah, John Wall's a slightly better shooter than what Russell Westbrook is and is a little bit more capable of playing off the ball than what Russell Westbrook is. There's a chance that this really works and that John Wall and James Harden are one of the best backcourts in the NBA and that the Christian Wood leap was very real last year. And then you mix those two or those three with Eric Gordon and PJ Tucker, and then you get 15 minutes a night off the bench with DeMarcus Cousins and David Waba comes back from injury and like Sterling Brown looks really good, right? Like there's a world where some of this works. There's just so many moving parts to bet on. And then the big one is obviously that James Harden, does not seem happy there is maybe the way to put it. When he's there. I don't know what to, this could go totally off the rails or it could actually work. They did well taking upside swings this summer. I like the idea of trading Russell Westbrook for John Wall and a first. I liked getting two first round picks for Robert Covington because I don't think Covington was quite as good of a fit for a switching defense as what Houston anticipated him being. But I don't know, man. Like, it's just kind of a mess, I feel like. And it's hard for me to bet on Houston making the playoffs right now. You know what I mean?
That's true. And at the same point, even it's so funny, like, if we end up seeing this, like, disinterested, half-hearted James Harden, I'm very fascinated to see what that looks like and how that's different. Because, like, his defensive effort has been inconsistent for a long time. I mean, yeah, they do the switching thing, and he actually does switch, so kudos. But the structure of their offense, I mean, I don't think he's going to be, like, passing off shots and, like, or intentionally missing or anything like that. So I honestly feel like their offense is, I mean, beyond the fact that they have some intriguing offensive personnel, I think their offense when Harden's on the floor is going to be totally fine. The defense is going to probably be more of a disaster for a bunch of different reasons. But it is a really weird circumstance to kind of piece all this together. And the other part of this that I think can't be discounted is the disaster potential is not necessarily, like, it's the worst thing in the world if your goal is for the Rockets to be competitive, obviously. But if a rebuild is in their future, there is a reason to maybe not be as bad as possible, but to be on the bad side of bad rather than to be, like, the vanilla version of bad. And right. I think that Wall for Westbrook does, I mean, Westbrook is many things, but one of them in this current status, I would argue that he's more of a floor raiser than John Wall, who, you know, might not even be on the floor to raise that floor. Yep. But then the other part of it is, you know, like, yeah, if the defensive stuff doesn't work out, and, like, I mean, I had this discussion with Matt Moore on Real Jam Radio recently, which a little bit, well, I wanted to get into it more, but we had to cover 30 teams in about the same amount of time we're doing 15, was, I think their offense with, like, if they make a Harden trade, their offense completely falls apart. Like, they can do some sort of egalitarian thing, but I don't think they have the straw that stirs the drink now. I mean, unless John Wall is John Wall. So that's okay. Like, if you're okay being bad, but it's an interesting question.
I feel like Houston would be better off making a decision now to move him because I don't see this team as a title contender. I think there is a case for keeping him and seeing, like, if a team with a high draft pick emerges as potentially being interested in James Harden. Like, I'm not taking the Nets deal, though. Like, are you taking that Brooklyn Nets deal for James Harden?
No, especially because I'm not as high on Caris LeVert as others are. Like, I think he's fine, but I don't think that he is your next superstar or anything like that. And the other big thing that can change is somebody's going to get more desperate. But that's just the way it, when teams aren't desperate right now, the odds are the number is going to go higher than it is. And so that could open up somebody bringing out an asset that we're not expecting or just a team coming out of the woodwork. I don't know exactly who that would be, especially when, I mean, the other way that it could swing is if Giannis signs this extension, then maybe somebody like Miami or Toronto or Dallas that's been hoarding their space, maybe they just completely go a different direction and say, well, we'll get into the mix now. That's a possibility, too. Maybe you just get more suitors by winning. Well, we'll know on Giannis before the season starts.
The problem with Miami is that Miami just doesn't have the assets to do this unless they move Bam. Like,
well, I mean, they do, like, Tyler Hero. I would rather have Tyler Hero on his contract than Caris LeVert on his. It just doesn't seem like something Miami would want overall.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But would there be a more interesting, like, culture, like we would find out the ultimate distillation of whether Heat culture is real by how much James Harden changes and how much the Heat change.
That would actually be pretty interesting. Yeah, I'm actually.
And that's why I want it to happen, but I don't think that it will.
Yeah, and like Dallas, I don't think makes a ton of sense because I don't want to see Rick Carlisle like lose the very little hair he has left. Like that feels like a bad fit next to Luka Doncic, right?
Okay, we should keep running though.
We should keep running. We should absolutely keep running here. Just real quick, let's take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back with more in a second here. Okay, the Los Angeles Clippers are up next. The Clippers actually didn't do like a crazy amount. So this is going to be a situation where we talk about what does running it back look like. They traded Landry Shamet and Rodney Magruder for Luke Kennard and I believe 4 second-round picks. Is that correct?
Yes.
They trade a future second rounder for Daniel Aturu. They end up with Jay Scrubb. They re-sign Patrick Patterson. They sign Marcus Morris to a 4-year, $64 million deal. And they re-sign Serge Ibaka. They lose Jamichael Green, which is probably not ideal for them, although they didn't quite utilize him in the way that I thought that they would last year. Do you have any other things I'm missing here with the Clippers that are
They lost Montrezl Harrell. They re-signed Reggie Jackson. And Doc Rivers is now no longer the coach. Ty Lue is the coach.
Yeah, I'm working off of a list here that is our internal list from The Athletic.
Yeah, well, I did off-season grades with Nate for Dunked On. So I'm just using that and then trying to remember what's happened since I did those.
Excellent.
But so like, what's interesting about the Clippers is it's so funny because I was higher on them than a lot of people before last season. And then obviously what happened. And then it kind of felt like it was going in the disaster mode because they lost Harrell, they lost Green, and then, you know, the Shamet thing is fine. It's interesting. We'll talk about it. But then Serge Ibaka, like if you look at what the Clippers gained and what they lost, I think they're a better playoff team. Maybe a worse regular season team just because of the overall quality they lost. But the reason why is because Ibaka makes life a lot easier on Ty Lue, because it's like, okay, you could just throw him in there and it makes a lot of sense. So all of the questions about, is Zubats good enough? Is he ready? Oh crap, he's in foul trouble. What about Jamichael Green? Like all of the hair pulling that I did about Doc Rivers' rotation in the Clippers playoff run last year, that stuff is a lot easier to manage when you have Serge Ibaka, who isn't a perfect player, but what he puts on the table, what he takes off is easy to work with.
Well, they needed a floor spacing big at the end of the day.
Right.
They needed someone that they could play at center, who can actually play center defensively, who can also space the floor. Like, they were not comfortable playing super small with Jamichael Green and Marcus Morris last year, it felt like.
Yeah, and maybe that's a part of why, you know, Doc Rivers didn't do it. I thought that he should. I thought the very limited amount of time that they did was there. But, like, yeah, it's...
I think this is a better team. Like, I'm just going to straight up say that. Like, I think this is a better team now. They fit better. Serge Ibaka is a better center than anything that they had last year. Luke Kennard is an enormous get for them. Luke Kennard is a much better basketball player than Landry Shamet, I think. He is capable of doing the same things coming off of screens that Landry Shamet is, except he can also be an on-ball creator and an on-ball passer in a way that Shamet is just incapable of. Like, you can very easily pair Luke Kennard with Patrick Beverley in the starting lineup and have a very competent backcourt next to Paul George and Kawhi Leonard in the front court. Like, this is a real, real dangerous roster now, I think. I am very in on the Clippers this year again, even though I was last year too.
The other possibility with Kennard, depending on how much Steve Ballmer's willing to pay, is this kind of parallels the Josh Richardson thing we talked about before. Kennard is a pending restricted free agent, and if it works out, or if they just want to, if Ballmer's willing to pay, they could just keep him around. And I think that is a real benefit for the Clippers. Yes, it won't be at the same price as Shamet, because Shamet was drafted later than Kennard, and so he has longer on a rookie scale contract. But my theory is that Kennard eventually replaces Lou Williams in the rotation as a guy who might not always start and might not always close, but can do a little bit of both, and just depending on how the matchups are and everything like that. And like Lou Williams, Kennard is more of a regular season guy than a playoff guy due to his defensive limitations. But it's a lot easier to have that player on the future Clippers not be Lou Williams because of the equity he has with the organization. So I don't know whether that means Lawrence Frank trades Lou Will during the season. That wouldn't stun me when you consider the, like, the reporting that Jovan Bua had on the kind of the rift within the Clippers. It wouldn't shock me if something like that happened. But also, it's just hedging your bets. You know, it didn't cost them that much to get Kennard. I like Shamet, but he wasn't really playing a ton. Also, he dealt with some weird physical stuff in terms of injuries and, I believe, COVID. I might be wrong on that. So yeah, I agree with you. I think they got better, and it looked bad at one moment in time, but I think things are going to work out pretty well for them.
The final thing here would be the Marcus Morris deal. They signed him to a 4-year, $64 million deal that I just don't even know, like, how that happens, because it's so much more than what the mid-level is, which is what he would have gotten from any other contender. Like, is he really going to leave?
Because they couldn't replace him. Like, that was the whole thing. And it's, I mean, here's the other practical point. I had brought up the idea that maybe the Clippers want to stay a little bit more flexible, because then they could have actually done some really interesting stuff in 21 if both Kawhi and Paul George had become unrestricted free agents. But that would have involved a lot of feather ruffling. And, you know, it was basically like, if Paul George leaves, then you can replace him. That's sort of an idea. But that always kind of felt unlikely. You know, those guys both chose, like, in some ways, they both, like, wanted to be on the Clippers. And so generally you think that players are going to want to stick around. And so at that point, other than that, it is really Steve Ballmer's money, because the Clippers weren't going to have spending power anytime soon. So it is negative value. You know, I think that Morris is overpaid, but I don't think it's by a heinous amount, because, I mean, he's a starting caliber player right now, and starting caliber players at the forward position are hard to come by.
I generally agree with that, but the problem is that Marcus Morris is also 31 years old already, and you're paying him now for 31, 32, 33, 34. And if Kawhi and Paul George do leave, which, you know, as we've kind of talked about, the only certainty in the NBA is uncertainty when it comes to player decisions, that becomes a very difficult deal to get off of. That is like, I get that you have to keep him, but I would have probably pressed harder with Rich Paul, especially given that you were losing Montrezl Harrell. I probably would have pressed harder with Rich Paul and said, look, we're giving him 452 or something like that, and trying to reduce this thing. But, you know, the Clippers brand right now is that they're just willing to pay for what they want, I guess. So, it's not the worst thing in the world. Let's go to the Lakers. The Lakers traded Danny Green in the number 28 pick for Dennis Schroeder. They signed Wes Matthews. They signed Montrezl Harrell. They re-signed Kentavious Caldwell-Pope to a 3-year, $40 million deal with a partial guarantee in year three. They re-signed Marcus Morris. They trade JaVale McGee. They sign Marc Gasol to a $5.2 million deal. They waived Jordan Bell, who was acquired in that JaVale McGee deal. Kostas Antetokounmpo re-signed his two-way contract, and then they re-signed Jared Dudley as well. I believe that's everything, right?
I will note just that you said Marcus Morris instead of Markieff, but
Markieff, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Did you say Wes Matthews?
I did say Wes Matthews, yeah. I think this Lakers team is...
It got lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. I think that this Lakers team is better than they were last year. I did not love the idea of trading Danny Green in number 28 for Dennis Schroeder in a vacuum, but it's very clear that they knew that they were going to be able to retain KCP and then replace Danny Green with Wes Matthews. So because that they knew that, they were very, very ready and able to get much better in a hurry, because this team is a lot better than they were last season, I think, now.
I'll push back on that a little bit by adding a caveat. I think they got much better in the regular season. I think that, you know, Harrell and Gasol to the front court rotation, that helps a lot. And getting Schroeder, you know, and then, I mean, the Schroeder plus, you know, the, let's call it a net subtraction from Danny Green to Wes Matthews. Yeah, Danny Green missed a bunch of shots in the finals. So be it. But here's my concern. The Lakers, it's not, did the Lakers get better or worse? It's use of resources. So my idea with the Lakers was, you have the mid-level exception, whichever one they were going to choose to use. You have their draft pick. You have, theoretically, if they wanted to trade Kyle Kuzma, they don't have many ways to reform this roster. Yeah. And they added a bunch of players who are good basketball players. But if we're accepting that the best form of the Lakers in most circumstances is LeBron at the 4 and Anthony Davis at the 5, then, and you think about that in those important lineups against the best teams, LeBron is going to have the ball in his hands just about all the time. I don't love the players they added in that context. I like them in almost every other context, but I don't love them in that one. And so the question is, how much do you value that context compared to every other one?
In this season particularly, I think that you do value the other contexts, because LeBron James and Anthony Davis are not going to want to play 70 games this year, right? And they need to at least tread water in the games where LeBron or Anthony Davis don't play. getting Montrezl Harrell, getting Marc Gasol allows them to do that in a way that I think is more capable, basically. Like they're going to have an easier time now treading water in those games. I totally agree with you that, like, I don't expect Montrezl Harrell to get many, like, minutes in important situations, because I do not like pairing him with Anthony Davis. It will make him better. It will make the team worse, I think. Marc Gasol is like a valuable rim protector. He can't move in space anymore, and he's a good ball mover and shooter, but like just having a body there at center, I think, is valuable for the Lakers in a season where you're going to have to deal with load management. And I think that having another creator like a Dennis Schroeder is going to be really, really important in what is going to be the greatest load management season of all time.
I think all that is completely fair. But will we care as much about all of that if Schroeder's not in the closing five, and or at least not in their best five, let's put it that way, and Montrezl Harrell is barely seeing the floor, and the Lakers fall short of winning the title?
And you're talking particularly like come playoff team.
Yeah, I'm talking conference finals, NBA finals. The Lakers, I mean, every expectation that they will be in that group. I mean, I would say right now they're probably the favorites to win the title. And they definitely are, like, I would assume in Vegas and all that. But it's like, so you have to think about that rarefied era, because that's the whole point. And an interesting question.
Here'd be my point, though. Like, they didn't lose anything from their closing lineup. They're essentially just replacing Danny Green with Wes Matthews, right? And they just added depth to be able to handle the other minutes.
Do you think that that Frank Vogel is going to A, see it that way, because, you know, he has to put those players on and off the floor, and that the players are okay with that? Like, there are all these complicated things. I mean, going back to, like,
yeah, that's fair.
Doc Rivers playing, oh yeah, the same guy, Montrezl Harrell, last year in the playoffs, even though he should not have. Like, that same issue could rear its head. And
well, the big problem there is, too, is that Rich Paul represents LeBron James, Anthony Davis, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and Montrezl Harrell. So,
correct. And so, like, Harrell, like, yeah, there's an interesting argument here that the person who got hurt the most by all this is Montrezl Harrell, because now he is, like, he got overshadowed by another guy they brought in at his same position. And even though Harrell's going to play more minutes and all that type of stuff, and he'll get his stuff to eat, like, the weird thing about going, if Harrell was basically hunting regular season empty calories to boost himself for a future year, he should have gone to Charlotte.
Yeah.
Because there you do that. And like, there's this weird thing that's like, if you're going to get regular season empty calories, it's better to do it on a non-playoff team, because the last thing people remember is you doing well.
Yeah. Christian Wood just got paid. Like,
right. Like, there's a real merit to that. And that, so with Harrell, if what people remember is either, I mean, unless I'm wrong and he thrives in those, and that would be wonderful. I'd love to be wrong. I'd love to see players succeed. Unless that happens, the two most likely scenarios are he's not on the floor and the Lakers are doing well without him, or he is on the floor and maybe they win including him, but like, it looks like he's out of place. And it's an interesting question. Like, Harrell, you can prioritize whatever you want. You can make whatever, but it's a challenging bet to have made.
Here's the final thing that I'll bring up here with the Lakers before we move on. They do replace Rajon Rondo with Dennis Schroeder. If we get playoff Rondo, Rondo is probably a better fit for them due to his passing and decision making than Dennis Schroeder. I would think you think the same,
yeah,
right?
The way Rondo played in the playoffs was better than I would expect Dennis Schroeder to do next year in the playoffs. However, it is also better than I would expect Rondo to do both
next year in playoffs.
Next year's playoffs, yeah. Or basically if you just re-rolled the dice. Like, he was great, and full credit to him for being great. But if I had to predict that it happened again, I'd be like, meh.
Yeah. And it's obviously worth mentioning that they lose Avery Bradley as well. The last thing here that I will say is that this team, I think, is now a bit better suited in terms of the contracts they have on this roster to execute a rather large trade to get someone. They would have struggled last year to salary match for bigger contracts. This year, they have enough of those mid-tier contracts, and they have an expiring one in Dennis Schroeder as well, to be able to make a real enormous mid-season move if they would want to.
Yeah.
The last thing, or that'll be it with the Lakers. Let's move to Memphis. Memphis did not really do much this offseason, so this will be pretty simple. What is this weird three-team trade where, like, they got Mario Hezonja? Is that right?
Yeah, I can explain it. So basically, the Grizzlies part of that deal was they traded two future seconds to get number 30, and they also picked up Mario Hezonja because the Blazers didn't want him.
They draft Desmond Bane. They draft Xavier Tillman. They re-sign DeAnthony Melton. They, like, decline a team option and then bring back Jontay Porter. They re-sign John Conchar to a 4-year, $9 million deal. They lose Josh Jackson. Did they lose anyone else on this roster? I don't know that they did.
I mean, technically, Anthony Tolliver is not going to be back, but no.
Yeah, so like this was a very quiet offseason for Memphis. Memphis got to where they got to very quickly last season, and I think that they were smart in kind of playing it patient and just seeing where John Morant and Jaren Jackson and Brandon Clark go this coming season, right?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have a ton of flexibility, but I thought the contracts they ended up with were reasonable. I think Melton's is fine. It's on the rich side, but I think it's fine. Jontay Porter, John Conchar, those are, you know, totally, totally fine deals as well. And you know Bane and Tillman better than I do, but I mean, they functionally got the 30th pick for 2 seconds, which is generally good business. Yeah. And so if Bane works out, then that's really nice. So like, yeah, I really liked what Memphis did. They just didn't do a ton.
Yeah, I had Desmond Bane at number 18, I think, on my board. So to get him for 2 second round picks is fucking fantastic work. Like, I think they did exceptional to do that. I had Xavier Tillman with a first round grade. So to go get him, I think, was fantastic work. I will also note that I think Xavier Tillman is a tailor-made fit long term for Jaren Jackson because of his rebounding ability and his ability to switch defensively.
So
and
to play alongside him or to replace him?
To play alongside him.
Okay, good to know.
Like, if they want to play Jaren Jackson at the four, which I think that they probably do because it's a little bit easier to run guys off of like crazy off-ball actions when they're playing the four, which Jaren Jackson does. Like, he runs off the screens and does all kind of crazy shit that 6'11" guys can't do. I really like the big man mix now of Jaren Jackson, Brandon Clark, and Xavier Tillman as long-term players. I think that DeAnthony Melton deal is going to be a steal to get him for 4 years, $36 million. And I think the Conchar deal has a chance to be a steal. I'm not quite sure necessarily if it'll play out that way, but I love the business that Memphis did this summer. They just didn't do a lot, and I think that that's probably worth just stopping there on this. So,
and that also gives us a little bit, well, not more time because we still need to move briskly through everyone else.
Yeah, Minnesota. They re-signed Wancho to a 3-year, $21 million deal. They re-signed Malik Beasley to a 4-year, $60 million deal. That is a team option on the fourth year. They did not end up with Ed Davis, did they? I can't remember how that
happened. Yeah, they did. They chose to bring him in, yeah.
Yeah, so they have Ed Davis for Jacob Evans, Amari Spellman, and a future second. They traded number 17 in James Johnson for Ricky Rubio, number 25 and number 28. They took Leandro Bolmaro following a draft day trade with, I want to say, the Knicks. Yeah.
Yeah.
They end up with Jaden McDaniels. They obviously draft Anthony Edwards. And they reached like a non-guaranteed deal with Rondae Hollis-Jefferson that I kind of sneaky like as well. Bizarre team. Very strange looking team. Let's start with the Anthony Edwards pick. Like, would you have taken Anthony Edwards at number one?
No.
Where would you have taken Anthony Edwards?
I had him third. Okay. I think that his you know, physical potential is, I mean, what I thought that there was kind of a line between him and some of the other ones. Now, I didn't see everyone, you know, the kind of the Neesmith, Devin Vassell class, like those kind of guys, but I'm guessing I probably would have ended up with Edwards third just because there's a chance, like, especially like one of the reasons he was so inefficient at Georgia was he was taking terrible shots, but there are a couple different ways that guys take terrible shots. And one of them could just be they kind of wanted him to. And so I think there's a more efficient player inside of Anthony Edwards. And so that plus, you know, he could conceptually be good at defense and all that, like that made him better than the kind of the rest. But I had him the weakest of that top three.
Yeah, I had him at three as well. I would not have gone this direction necessarily, but nonetheless, the Minnesota Timberwolves chose to. He is theoretically the best fit with Karl Towns and D'Angelo Russell from a positional perspective, although all three of those guys have proven to be very apathetic defenders throughout the course of their career. It made it all the more curious to me, though, that they took Anthony Edwards after they re-signed Malik Beasley to a four-year, $60 million deal. Malik Beasley is dealing with like very serious legal allegations right now. To give him 3 years, $45 million guaranteed is... I can't even fathom doing that. That is absolutely crazy to me.
It's the kind of contract that we could have expected for Beasley if you just if you had to sign him on the last day pre-bubble and just said, okay, great, you saw him for eight games or whatever the heck it was, and what is he worth right now, and ignored everything that happened after that, both in terms of their roster and, of course, the off-the-court issues.
And you just drafted a guy that is going to push Malik Beasley to the bench. You cannot play all four of Anthony Edwards, Malik Beasley, D'Angelo Russell, and Karl Anthony Towns and not expect to give up 125 points per 100 possessions. Like, that is the first, like, completely... I understand the process behind trading for D'Angelo Russell. I didn't love it, but I understood it. I didn't love taking Anthony Edwards at one, but I understood it, right? Malik Beasley is the first move that Gerson Rosas has made where I'm like, okay, this is a dumbfounding decision.
A real challenge. I mean, but to go back to something you said about Marcus Morris, it's also who in the world was going to give him this contract?
Yeah.
Like the,
I have no idea.
And when you consider like the one of my biggest problems with Minnesota's offseason, and I have a bunch of them, is they're now incredibly like limited in terms of their flexibility, spending power, all that kind of fun stuff. Not only for the coming year, but for the following year. Like they didn't even get to use the mid-level exception this year because they had so much other stuff and because they're not going to pay the luxury tax for a team that is this weak. So, okay, where do things go from here? And like if, for example, they traded James Johnson and Rubio is a good player. He will make them better. Not that much better, but better. But he's also paid $17 million for next year. So that means now the Wolves can't really spend next year either. And so they're really tied up now for 2 years. And the other just, and I hate, you know, pushing all this stuff, you know, the way that everybody's kind of looking miles ahead of where we are. But if they're pretty much this team for 2 years, then that means if we're kind of thinking, okay, 22 is when they can really start making moves. Karl Anthony Towns will be 2 years away from unrestricted free agency at that point.
Oh yeah, that is like they are going to have to move him if they don't make the playoffs within the next 2 years and don't look like they are anywhere near it. Like if they're nowhere near the mark, he's probably going to ask for a trade in 2022, I would think. Like what?
And it's also like, I mean, Towns, it's possible that he, you know, qualifies for the Supermax and that maybe he would want to do something like that. But it's also, if the team isn't going to be super good, then that makes it harder to get on an all-NBA team. And I just think they're in a really bad situation, and not all of that is Rosas' fault. Well, more of it is Glenn Taylor's fault than anything else. But they're still there. And it's frustrating.
Yeah. We don't think this team is anywhere near a playoff team next year, right?
I mean, not in this West. I mean, there's a chance that their offense is quite good, but how in the world are they going to defend?
Yeah, like they're relying wholly on Josh Okogie and Jared Culver.
Like they have their forward defense is astonishing. I mean, they you know, maybe like that, like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson maybe should start for them, and they got him on a minimum non-guaranteed deal. And I like Rondae, but Rondae Hollis-Jefferson should not start on a team that wants to be good.
Yeah, and like I didn't hate the Wancho deal. Maybe this is where we end positively. I didn't hate the Wancho deal.
Yeah, 3 years, with 21 million. Partially guaranteed third year. Yeah, absolutely. Totally fine with it.
But this is not a good team. Like, this is going to be a bad team.
Well, and so I guess maybe the upside is at some point maybe Jaden McDaniels can take on some of this role, but it's going to take him time. It always takes guys time.
Yeah, he's 2 years away. Like, he's not ready to play a part of a winning team yet. So, yeah, no, I am not excited by the Minnesota Timberwolves right now. The New Orleans Pelicans. The Pelicans did a lot of little things. They traded for Steven Adams, which is curious to me for a number of reasons, but they traded for him and then signed him to a 2-year, $35 million extension. So he is a New Orleans Pelican for 3 more years. They re-signed Brandon Ingram to a 5-year, $158 million deal. They signed Wenyen Gabriel. They signed Willie Hernan Gomez and Sedarius Thornwell. They lose Frank Jackson, Etuan Moore, Derek Favors, and Jahlil Okafor. They traded the number 24 pick for a 2023 first round pick. Obviously, they lose Drew Holiday is the big move here as well. They essentially traded Drew Holiday for 3 first rounders and 2 pick swaps, as well as Eric Bledsoe, George Hill. Weird offseason for New Orleans, but they're still in like the growing and molding this roster around Brandon Ingram, Zion Williamson, and Lonzo Ball. Kind of mode. So I don't hate it, but the Steven Adams move was curious to me.
Not only trading for Steven Adams, and remember, they gave up the first round pick that they acquired in the RJ Hampton deal in the Steven Adams deal. So they that is another kind of challenge of this, is that they functionally they gave up first for Adams and then extended him 2 years, $35 million. I personally viscerally dislike the Adams Zion fit, even though I like both of them as players. And the way that I've described this, I'd love to have a conversation with David Griffin about it. But the way that I've articulated the problem I have is that, like, people said, oh, Steven Adams is a good screener, all this kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, the problem isn't with the guy in the screening action, it's with the big man who is not. And so if you're setting a high pick and roll with Zion Williamson and point guard X, then where is Steven Adams and what is the guy defending him doing? And so the problem is when you have a player who doesn't space the floor and Zion on the floor together, is that the guy defending Steven Adams, when that high pick and roll happens, that player is going to be in the paint gumming up the works because, yeah, okay, maybe you could do a dump off to Steven Adams. First of all, that big man is still there, not a big deal. And it's not like Steven Adams is really going to make you pay enough. So that means it's more bodies for Zion and Kyra Lewis or Bled or whoever to deal with. But it's also an additional potential for injury for Zion. That's something that I'm concerned about. And like also Steven Adams, he's been in the league forever. He's been a part of some really good defensive teams. But I don't think that he is Rudy Gobert. I don't think that he is so undeniably great at the other stuff to justify it.
Yeah, I love Steven Adams as a player and like as a human being. I really don't like this fit.
To double down on it by committing, like they could have easily traded for him and then it worked or didn't work and then you just sign him after that. But to say, okay, we're committing to this now with what might be a negative value extension is another mistake. It's a mistake compounding a mistake.
I just like don't really get it. Like,
well, I mean, but here's the thing. David Griffin has evaluated the big men position pretty consistently this sort of way that he wanted, because they drafted Jackson Hayes.
That's what I was going to say. You just drafted Jackson Hayes.
Like, that's for better or for worse, and I have a very strong opinion about which way it is, that he wants to play that kind of player next to Zion Williamson. He has devoted significant resources at this point to doing so. And that is telling. And I think he's wrong. But the other part of this, and that's why, you know, like I think New Orleans still had a successful offseason, is they got a haul for Drew Holiday. Now, it is a weird kind of, like, if you want to think about it as a portfolio, it is a weird portfolio because the Bucks could end up being very good for this time, and the Bucks certainly hope to. But I think there is way more upside in this for New Orleans than the Lakers picks, by virtue of the Bucks are a less consistent organization historically. They don't, you know, like Anthony Davis is signed for a while now too. Like you have a lot of this kind of stuff lined up. And also just because like, while there's a very distinct chance that Giannis resigns, it has not happened yet. And it had not happened as of the time of that. And also the Bucks are older and they're like, they're going to probably be more fragile. And yeah, Giannis is amazing and he's unbelievable. And as long as he's there, they're going to be a damn good team. But we don't know how long that's going to be. And so like, I think these, so there's this question about like Nate and I got into this a little while ago about what is the best traded pick asset in the league. I don't think the Bucks picks are there now, but I think they could be.
Yeah, I agree with that. I actually totally agree with that. You could tell me that 2027 first rounder for Milwaukee is like a number two overall pick at some point, and that would not be stunning by any stretch of the imagination.
And it could have been that the Bucks had an amazing run between now and then. Like there are ways that this could work out beautifully for Milwaukee, and that pick is still amazing.
Yeah, like there is a chance that Milwaukee wins the 2021 NBA title and that the pick still ends up being the number two overall pick. And it will have been 100% worth it for Milwaukee because they won a title in 2021. Like, that's okay. It's just that these picks have a chance to be very, very valuable. I don't love this roster at all. Like, I think it's I don't think they're done making moves over the course of the next year with this roster. Like, Eric Bledsoe is basically going to have to start next to Lonzo now, right? And
yeah, it's a very weird roster.
You're essentially starting Eric Bledsoe, Lonzo, Brandon Ingram, Zion, and Steven Adams?
I mean, maybe they start Redick and have one of those guys come off the bench, but then that brings a bunch of questions too. And Bledsoe's weird because I think that he wasn't a good fit for the Bucks because he's not that kind of player. Like the last two rounds of the playoffs, or in this case, the second round, he's not that guy, especially not in Bud Boonholzer's system. But he's a lot better than that. And so it'll be interesting. Like, I think, like, Eric Bledsoe is still a very good basketball player. I think he could look great this year. And New Orleans, like, I don't think they're going to be a second through fourth round of the playoffs team. So maybe he gets that. And so, like, there are a lot of things about New Orleans that I like, but I don't like how it all fits together. And so maybe that ends up working. Maybe it doesn't work, but it doesn't affect it too much. And that's why the Adams thing is frustrating, is because they could have been, like, it could have been so much closer. Like, if it doesn't work out, they could have been more flexible, and they're not.
The Oklahoma City Thunder did so many things this summer that I'm just going to read who is now on their roster.
That's probably the best way to do it.
Lou Dort, Admiral Schofield is somehow on this roster. I didn't even know that. TJ Leaf, Josh Hall is on a two-way, Trevor Ariza, Justin Jackson, Kenrich Williams, George Hill, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Alexei Pokuševski, Mike Muscala, Hamidou Diallo, Frank Jackson, Darius Miller, Darius Bazley, Omer Yurtseven, Isaiah Roby, and Ty Jerome. They also obviously have how many first rounders that they've acquired? Like eight?
I think they got, I have it that they got three this year, but then they have a bunch of them from other stuff.
Oh, yeah. You're right. You're right. They got, I would have guessed four. So yeah, cause then, yeah, you're right. Cause they got one for Kelly Oubre. They got one for Steven Adams. They got one for
Chris Paul.
Chris Paul. And then I was including,
and one from Philly. So you're right. They got four because they got the one from Philly as well.
Yeah. And then in the eight, I was including Pokuševski, which they acquired. And, who's the other one that they acquired? Why is my brain breaking? Maybe no one else. It might not have been another one. I might have just overestimated. Look, this is a total rebuild. They got some high upside picks. How well do you think they did in the Chris Paul deal?
I think they did really well. I mean, not only did they get an asset in that first round pick, but they also got players that were good enough. Like, they got Ty Jerome, who could help them. And they also got players who, one, they already moved for positive value. And actually, both of which, Rubio and Oubre. So, yeah, I thought they did very well.
I thought they did very well as well. Ty Jerome is a former first-round pick that I think has a chance to be a good rotation player long-term. I mean, this was a fine performance. They were interested in Alexei Pokuševski, as I've said on this podcast, for a long time. And they moved up and got their guy. He is a super high-upside player and the kind of player that teams like this should be taking swings on at the end of the day. They have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander as a building block, who is a top 10 rookie contract asset in the NBA now that some guys have graduated. They have Pokuševski, who can be a super high upside player. They have Darius Bazley, who is very interesting. They have Lu Dort, who, frankly, like, I would be canvassing the market to see what I could get for Lu Dort, because I don't really see a ton of use for him on this roster. And I bet you that a team would be interested in giving up, like, a semi-real asset, especially if he plays well early this season. Yeah, Oklahoma City did well, or as well as humanly possibly could be done, in tearing down an entire roster.
Agreed. And the only thing that I didn't love was I didn't think they squeezed Philly hard enough in the Horford-Danny Green deal.
I was going to mention that as well.
Al Horford's contract, you know, yes, Philly was selling at the bottom of his value in all likelihood, but they were still selling at the bottom. And Philly was leveraged, and Sam Presti didn't use that in the same way that he did with the Clippers and the Paul George deal. And I don't think it's going to, like, kill them, and I also don't think that Philly had really any blue chip stuff. Yeah, sure, it would have been great to get some of the maybe one of their young guys. That would have been really interesting to kind of to get something else. Maybe you could have gotten Matisse Thybulle in that deal. That would have made me love it. To get another good player. But overall, I mean, the volume of resources that they got back. And the single craziest part to me about Oklahoma City's situation is that the cycle hasn't finished yet. Like, so a lot of times you take on these assets more like the Danny Green, Al Horford deal, where you get back, like, you end the chain with a toxic asset. No, right now, so like earlier on in this chain, they had Rubio and Oubre, who they moved. Now they still have Ariza, totally reasonable contract. George Hill, totally reasonable contract. And so, like, they can still do something else with those guys, whether it's use them as a mechanism to take on bad money, get a very marginal asset for them now or later. It's to be able to do that without saddling your books is totally ridiculous. Like, I thought that Presti did a really good job, not a perfect job, but an excellent one.
The Phoenix Suns, I think, probably got better than any team in the NBA this summer. They acquired Chris Paul in that Ricky Rubio, Kelly Oubre, Ty Jerome, Jalen Lecque, and a 2022 first round deal. They drafted Jalen Smith, which I didn't love, but whatever. It's small potatoes in the context of this summer. They signed Jay Crowder to a 3-year, $29 million contract. They re-signed Dario Saric to a 3-year, $27 million contract. They got Tyshawn Alexander on a 2-way deal, which I really like. They got Etuan Moore on a $2.3 million vet minimum, which I really like. They signed Langston Galloway on a 1-year, $3.6 million deal with the biannual exception, and they re-signed Javon Carter. I just love it. Like, I think that it is really genuinely a very, very impressive summer that is going to see them morph into not just a playoff team, but like a dangerous playoff team.
I'm very positive, a little bit less positive than you. I think that they got deeper, which is a big help. Adding Jay Crowder to the forward rotation is great. Two things that kind of stick in my craw a little bit. So one is their center depth is still makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, Bane's got a contract that, you know, and an opportunity that they couldn't have matched. So it's not like, oh, they made a mistake there, but that could end up being a limitation. And the other one is it's a stylistic thing. And that's the way Chris Paul plays. I'm not going to say wants to play. I'm going to say the way he plays, because he plays, is very different from what made me so excited about the Suns last year. And so how the creative tension that leads to the Suns team, that might lead to some, let's call them inefficiencies. Like, it's just going to lead to the Suns being different. And so that could work out well. It could be a little bit dicey, but I love Chris Paul. I've been on board with that for a long time now. So I think I'm a little bit more cautious than you, but I am very positive.
I am cautious. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I am, I'm not like diving 1,000% in with the Phoenix Suns, but Chris Paul and Devin Booker, that's maybe the best backcourt in the NBA.
It's in the short list at bare minimum.
Yeah. Like, those two pairing together is an unbelievable backcourt. I think that Chris Paul is really going to help DeAndre Ayton develop defensively. DeAndre took a leap last year defensively to where, I'm not going to sit here and say he was like a good defender, but if the line is average, I think he was like just a tick like past the average line in terms of what he was defensively last year. He moved his feet really well. He was a much better contester around the basket. He was much better rotationally than what he was as a rookie, but he still has a little bit of room to grow there. Overall, it was just a really, really big improvement. And I think that being able to operate in ball screen defense with Chris Paul, who can hopefully teach him gap defense a little bit better. Like, I think that that stuff really matters. I think it's really, really going to help him. They have better lineup versatility now with Jay Crowder. They can go big. They can go small. Yeah, they lose Aaron Baines and they lose like a real backup center. But yeah, like this team is a real threat, in my opinion. And that's before we even talk about Mikal Bridges being just like an absolute monster defensively, who is going to really translate at the NBA level, in my opinion. It has already, I guess, is the fairest way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move to Portland. This was kind of a quiet other than like the Robert Covington move summer. They acquired Robert Covington for Trevor Ariza and 2 first-round picks. They reacquired Enes Kanter for reasons beyond my comprehension. They re-signed Rodney Hood in a curious series of moves where he declined his player option, and then they re-signed him to a 2-year, $21 million deal with a second-year non-guaranteed. They signed Derek Jones to a 2-year, $19 million deal. They signed Harry Giles to a 1-year deal. Re-signed Carmelo Anthony. I love this offseason from Portland and think they are also like a very real contender to finish like fifth in the Western Conference next year.
I really like it. Kind of paralleling the Suns, the little bit of caution that I have is, one, how is Terry Stotts going to utilize all this? Like, you have a lot of players that I like, but getting the combinations and permutations right is going to be a challenge. And then the other one is, well, I'm fine with the Covington deal. You know, they gave up some real assets. This is, again, a really big bet by Neil O'Shea on his evaluation of kind of like bench guys, because you think about that they used all these resources for the front court, and their front court got a lot better. Like, I mean, getting Covington, getting all these other players. But the challenge is, well, not necessarily health, because Lillard and McCollum have been rocks, but this is a lot on Anthony Simons. If we're really talking about them being high level, like, they have to stay healthy in the backcourt and they have to be good.
Yes, that is a big bet on Anthony Simons. And it's a big bet on Dame Lillard and CJ McCollum staying healthy. That's largely happened, though, throughout the course of their career, right? Like, we should feel okay about betting on that, right?
Yeah, I mean, but it's just even in the minutes they sit and, you know, like all those kind of, there aren't even options really back there.
It's no, there aren't.
Kind of like, they don't even have like the Shabazz Napiers, the like some of the like pack on, like, they've found some real value on the margins in those in other years. They don't even have lottery tickets in the backcourt right now.
But I think those would be easy to go out and acquire on the trade, sure. Like on the trade market. Like, they have this Rodney Hood deal now, which is actually a very valuable trade asset for another team.
It is. I especially like, that's the nice thing about having Covington on a valuable contract for next year, is that theoretically, you know, it, depending on what happens with Zach Collins and his extension, there could be something there. But I don't think that's how and why the Blazers did this. I think they're going to run into the issue where Hood finishes the year on Portland and then you don't pick up the non-guarantee and then you just kind of see where things go.
Yeah, I think that that's the most likely outcome here. But I also really like taking a shot on Derek Jones. He provides the defensive athleticism that they really need. And Robert Covington does that as well. And Robert Covington is going to be a much better fit in this drop coverage scheme than he was in Houston's switching scheme, because he's so ridiculous away from the ball. They can play him at the 4 next to Nurkic at the 5, and he's just going to wreak havoc on the backside, in my opinion. Like, well, this is
having Derek Jones also theoretically. I mean, first of all, if they're playing a team that doesn't have a good wing scorer, it's going to be even better. But if they're playing a team that does, theoretically, their best 5 in certain circumstances is going to be probably Derek Jones checking that guy, and then Covington still being that kind of free safety who's just going wherever he needs to go to muck up whatever the other team wants to do. Like, Covington, part of the other reason he was miscast in Houston was at times he was kind of their stopper, and that's not what he's best at. So I think that Covington is in a good situation to succeed. I again, that's another thing I like about what Portland did.
And then the last thing I'll mention here is Harry Giles. Harry Giles to a 1-year minimum deal is a really smart gamble from them, I think, because he has really real dexterity in passing and dribble handoff ability. Like, that's a perfect backup center for them, especially if they want to keep playing Zach Collins at the four, which some of these moves make it a little bit less likely that they play Zach Collins at the four, I think. But Harry Giles is a really good fit with what in their, with what they run. The last thing, or second to last team, third to last team, second to last
third
team.
Third to last.
We have three more. The Sacramento Kings. They didn't really do a crazy amount, so we don't have to spend a lot of time on them. They draft Tyrese Halliburton, Robert Woodard, and Jamias Ramsey. They bring Alvin Gentry in as an associate head coach, which I think is like maybe the most valuable thing that they did. They sign Glenn Robinson III to a partial guaranteed deal. They re-sign Daquan Jeffries to a two-year, $3 million deal. They brought in Hassan Whiteside on a one-year minimum. That's all that they did, right?
Did you mention Glenn Robinson III?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. Like, the other important thing, I mean, so there are two other things you could argue is more valuable than Gentry. One is Vlade Divac is no longer making their personnel decisions. Monty McNair is much more capable of doing that. And while I didn't love everything about Sacramento's offseason, having McNair at the helm is an important plus. And then Tyrese Halliburton. I mean, that Halliburton falling to 12 is more good fortune than amazing drafting. But I mean, I didn't see everybody, but I had Halliburton. God, did I have him fourth? I think I did.
Well, I will tell you, I think that they kind of finagled that a little bit.
Entirely possible.
Yeah. Like the impression I've gathered is that like the Halliburton camp thought that was a good landing spot and like,
and it is,
didn't work out with Phoenix and like didn't work out with like the Wizards and stuff like that. So like, make that the soft landing spot a little bit.
I will be angry if Halliburton ends up being good. I will be angry at the Suns for not drafting him for a decade. Because yeah, like I loved like the Halliburton, like I didn't think he was going to fall far enough to make that a possibility, and I sold myself so hard on Halliburton Booker even with Chris Paul, and then it's just I kind of, especially with Chris Paul, where you give Halliburton a little bit of time to develop and then it just getting taken away so they could draft a backup center was crushing. But their loss, Sacramento's game.
The obvious move that we have to discuss here is Bogdan Bogdanovic as well. Look, I would have matched this deal. I think you would have as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah, like it's a no-brainer match. I get that like you kind of want to
move on. It's not a no-brainer. I don't think it's a no-brainer match. I think that it is a match because that's a lot of money for Bogdanovic, who, you know, like this is the type of contract that is reasonable, and reasonable contracts actually have a larger chance of failing than you think for players who might not have a ton of untapped potential.
Yeah, and I think that's reasonable, but you got to keep the asset at the end of the day. Like you just absolutely have to keep the asset.
Like you could potentially move him a year from now for a team that wants help, and that like it's agreed, especially when Sacramento's not doing anything else with this. Like they ended up getting real value on the margins with Hassan Whiteside and Glenn Robinson III and some of the other stuff, but the opportunity cost of bringing him back is pretty low.
Like Milwaukee is not going away from wanting Bogdan Bogdanovic, right? Like this is not going to change in a year from now. Like they would have been able to try and squeeze Milwaukee for assets long term. Right?
Yeah.
That's really it. Like Sacramento didn't do a crazy amount. They're probably not a playoff team this year. So let's move on. The San Antonio Spurs, again, not a team that did a crazy amount, but I liked what they did. Drafted Devin Vassell and Trey Jones, both of whom I had as top 20 guys. Devin Vassell, I think I had at 11 or 12. They guaranteed Trey Lyles deal, which like whatever. They signed Drew Eubanks to a 3-year minimum deal, which whatever, right? They re-signed Jakob Poeltl to a 3-year, $27 million deal, and I really like that move. Other than that, I, again, think that this was a quiet offseason for them where I don't see anything else. Do you have anything else?
I mean, we'll have to see how their picks work out. I've heard very good things about Vassell, so I'm excited about that. Quindary Witherspoon I like on a two-way. And, yeah, I mean, I think that the Poeltl deal is more fair than amazing, just because I don't, you know, it's the idea, you and I talk about this a lot with bigs, of like, will he be a top 10 center in the league? Probably not, but you're not paying him like that, so it's totally fine. Like I would much rather give Poeltl this contract than, let's say, Mason Plumlee, even though Mason Plumlee is an accomplished center in for of what he does. So yeah, I'm totally fine with San Antonio's offseason, and if Vassell and Trey Jones end up being good, then I'll love it.
Yeah, and look, their moves are going to come in season. Like, someone is probably going to pay them to acquire LaMarcus Aldridge at some point. I would venture someone is going to pay them to acquire DeMar DeRozan at some point, assuming that they're not a playoff team. I don't think this team will be a playoff team, but they could be close. We'll see what they do. Like, I feel like this offseason is almost like an incomplete grade because they didn't move their two big pieces yet, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
The Utah Jazz are the last team here. Mike Conley opted into his deal. They took Udoka Azubuike with the 27th overall pick. They moved Tony Bradley for the 38th overall pick. They acquired Elijah Hughes in the second round. I believe that they retained Jarrell Brantley somehow. They signed Derek Favors to the 3-year, $27 million deal. They signed Jordan Clarkson to a 4-year, $52 million deal. Yeah, they re-signed Brantley to a two-way. They signed Trent Forrest to a two-way. They moved Rajon Tucker in order to just get off of that roster spot. And then the big one is obviously that they signed Donovan Mitchell to the 5-year, $163 million extension. I, like, don't love this offseason, really, for Utah. How do you feel about it?
I don't love it either. I mean, the biggest thing is actually giving Mitchell that player option. I think that that potentially, it gives him a lot of leverage. It means that he could leave a year earlier. There was no reason to give that to Mitchell. He's not Anthony Davis. He's not Jason Tatum. You know, like, as much as I like Donovan, he's just, he hasn't been that player yet and well, didn't like, have here, that kind of leverage.
Here's the other thing on it, too. Gordon Hayward, like, they went through this a few years ago with Gordon Hayward where they let him test the market and he ended up only on a 3-year deal essentially with that player option on the fourth. Or was it just a straight 3-year deal? I can't remember.
No, that was a 3+1.
Yeah, 3+1. Like, losing that extra year of value really matters. It really genuinely matters. So losing Donovan Mitchell's fifth year on that rookie rookie extension is enormous for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And they paid Jordan Clarkson a lot of money. I think that he is useful for them, but that, you know, depending on how the new ownership is willing to, you know, really willing to pay the tax, like, it's another one of those, kind of like the Monte Morris one I talked about before, where it's like, it's not a bad deal, but in the context of everything else, it might be thorny later on.
I think that's a pretty bad deal. I'm just going to say that. Yeah. I would much rather have done like a 1-year, $20 million deal. Like, does he not agree to that?
Yeah. Oh, he probably does. And then with Favors, like, it's not a terrible one, but it seems like they gave him more than the market was going to bear, and giving him a player option on the third year, that gives Favors more control. And yeah, there are ways that they that the Jazz can use him, and he can help, and he's kind of overqualified if they want to, you know, like, kind of play him with Gobert and then have him sit, like, you know, like, there are a lot of different ways they can do this. But again, like, is that really gonna, you know, build their asset base, get them younger and better and all that? Not really. And so it's not, I just didn't really love their offseason. It's not terrible. It's not going to ruin them or anything like that. And I don't know that they needed, like, one of the ways of thinking about Favors is as a hedge for Gobert. Maybe, but I don't think they needed to give that money to Favors right now for that purpose.
And then draft Udoka Azubuike as well.
Right.
Like, that's your hedge. You use the 27th overall pick on Udoka Azubuike to not sign or use any of these assets, the mid-level or the draft pick, on, like, a defensive wing seems like a mistake to me. They had a chance to actually shore up their wing defense. And look, they have Royce O'Neal. Like, Ingles is not a terrible defender. Like, he's just slow-footed, but he's really smart and he knows where he needs to be. Donovan Mitchell can be a good defender who can move up the lineup a little bit at times, but they needed another guy who can guard wings, and they did not get that. And that's, I think, my biggest concern for them. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
That's through 15. Danny, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on in your life, man.
Written works at The Athletic. You can get everything there. Have a piece coming up. I'll have stuff pretty much throughout the remaining off season. Going to probably do an extension preview series next week. We'll see how that works out. And then audio, Real Jam Radio is once a week. Sam is a frequent guest, a much appreciated guest. Then Dunked On, we do one public episode a week and 4 subscription. That's called Dunked On Prime now. You can check that out. And then during the year, I have many projects, some of which are announced, some of which are not, and you can keep an eye on that.
go follow Danny. He is one of the best in the business at this and just a terrific human being in general. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We will be back next week with NBA win total over unders. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.